Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies and how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears, we will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast, through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome back to Fat Joy. I'm your host, Sophia, and I'm very excited to talk to my guest today because I have Erin Flores with us. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Sophia. I'm really happy to be here.
Yay. Well, and Erin, I always like to start the podcast by, I've kind of gotten to this habit of sharing how I know the guest, kind of like track through. And so someone, a guest who was on your podcast, who had been listening to my podcast, slid into my DMs and said, "Hey, Sophia, love your podcast, but where are all the men?" And I thought, oh, that's a really good point. Why don't I have more male guests? And so he recommended you. I checked you out. We've had a conversation and here you are. So hello, man.
Hello. Yeah, I'm happy to be here and sort of offer whatever perspective I can.
Oh my gosh, Erin, you have so many perspectives to offer. I cannot wait. And so why don't you tell everyone who you are and then we're going to get into all that you do in the world.
My name is Erin Flores and I'm a dietitian and certified body trust provider. I have a private practice in LA. My pronouns are he, him. I am a white cisgender man living in a fat body. I use the word fat to identify my body all the time. And it's okay to call me fat. Doesn't give you permission to call other people fat, but for me, it's okay. And I'm Jewish. I was born in Mexico. My dad is from Mexico. My mom is from the States. And yeah, I'm married. I have twins. And I've been doing this work for a long time now, like 17 years, which is weird to say out loud, and been working exclusively with folks who have eating disorders for about 7 or 8 now. My career took a big sort of roundabout path to get here. But I finally settled into this and it's, I have the best job ever. So I love it.
Oh, that's amazing. So my next question, as you know, and everyone listening knows, is always what's your relationship to the word fat? And so I definitely want to answer that. And I'm also really curious as a part two, and I'll write it down so I remember to ask you, because oftentimes I say, I want to know this, and then I forget I've asked it, as you know, as a podcaster, is I would love to get a sense too of how you found yourself in this work, the pivot that landed you in eating disorders, you know, like, I just think that is, that's really interesting as well. So let's start with your relationship to the word fat, how you began to claim that word, and then we'll go into what you do in the world.
Yeah, it's an interesting question to sort of talk about a relationship with a word. And especially when it's a word that is so taboo in so many ways. It's almost like, I hear, if someone like cuts me off, right? Or if I cut them off or whatever, there's some, you know, someone's yelling from their car, right? It seems like the word fat is going to show up in some way as they yell at me or someone, right? Like, it's like the lowest, like, low hanging fruit, like way you can hurt someone is to call them fat. And, you know, I've heard that word, especially used in that way for, I mean, probably almost my whole life, really. I mean, like, you know, I remember hearing it other kids, you know, put people down by using the word fat. And it wasn't until, I mean, honestly, probably in the last 10 years that there was even a concept for me that this word could be neutral. And so, you know, it's almost been a word that wasn't even said, right, up until 10 years ago, right? And like, I say it even now and people sort of shudder, right, that I said something like the worst thing ever, right? And it, like, a good example of that is when my kids were in elementary school, one of the parents, it was like drop off, right? We were just talking and they said, oh yeah, my daughter used the word fat. And I told her, like, we don't use that word in this house. And I was like, oh, we use it all the time. And I don't think she quite got what I was saying, right? But I was like, no, it's not a bad word. It's, you know, it's just a descriptor. And you know, we don't pull away from that word at all. I think if it's weaponized, that's different. But like, she didn't get it. And I probably didn't explain it as well as I just did right now. But yeah, it's a really interesting relationship. And I think I started to use it to identify my own body again fairly recently. And I think it's because I felt I saw other folks doing it. And I noticed, and those folks were like really close colleagues and friends. And I really appreciated the power of like saying, like, I'm just going to use this word and try to take, again, the weaponization out of it and have it just be neutral. Like, I have, you know, a Hawaiian shirt on. I am fat. Like, it's not anything else than that. It's a descriptor. And, you know, it's been helpful. You know, I think still people don't quite know what to do with it when I say it. You know, I used it over the weekend, right? And I was like, I love Metallica, right? And I just went to a concert and I bought a concert tee and, you know, you got to pay more for larger sizes, right? So I got like the size I needed. Thankfully they had it, but I got the size and they're like, oh, how much was the shirt? And I was like, well, it's, you know, $45, but I got it's actually sort of 50 because I'm fat. And they're like, what? I go, yeah, it's sort of like a, you know, fat tax, right? Like I got to pay more for that because it's fat, you know, because I'm fat and I need a bigger size. And they're like, oh, well, and like, there was like a pause and like, so what do I do with this? Like, is this person like, is this self-deprecating? Is this like humor? No, it's just, I'm just using the word to like name it. And this is it. And we're going to move on because it's nothing more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And probably even the phrase fat tax may have been new to them as well. Aaron, did you grow up fat?
It's a really good question. I mean, looking back, no, but my body has never fit the ideal. So I grew up in LA, which in when your body doesn't fit the ideal is sort of fucked. You know, and I grew up in an area that's close to the beach, which is even more like fucked up, right? Because everyone is like they're all surfers and they're all like, you know, going to the beach every day. And I'm like, I don't want to really go to the beach and take my shirt off and whatever. So, but I wouldn't say that I was, you know, I wouldn't have been bullied for being fat, right? But I knew my body didn't fit the way everyone else's did. And I saw my first dietitian when I was 15 and it was for weight loss. And so again, it wasn't like it was like, yeah, I was in a larger body, but I don't know if it was fat. Right. And I really, but since college, like, yeah, my weight has gone up and down. And so I've never really fit the ideal. Like, I've always sort of been in a larger body.
Yeah. And so starting at 15 with the dietitian and perhaps even before, did you do the whole weight cycling roller coaster? Was that part of your experience?
So here's like the interesting part of being, you know, a man with this, right? Is I saw dieting was never even, I saw my mom dieting. I saw family members dieting. I never thought that was for me up until I saw the dietitian. And I went because, you know, my mom encouraged me to go. And, you know, we've talked about this now as adults and, you know, she was doing the best she could. I'm not upset at her for doing it at all. But like she sent me to see this person that she was working with. And it was for the express purpose of losing weight. And now the interesting thing is I didn't do anything she told me to do. Because I'm 15. And why would I listen to someone at that point in my life? So I literally sat in my car once I was 16 and seeing her and like faked my food journal. And then she had me weigh myself in her home office. So I just said it was like a little less than it was last time. Right. And she was like, oh, you're my perfect client. Right. And whatever. I was like, yeah, I'm not doing shit here. But I really, you know, I think the weight cycling piece really started when I was, in college and once I dropped out of college, and then I went back at 30, but when I dropped out of college, it really, that's where I hit a lot of weight cycling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was later in my life, but when I did it pretty hard.
Yeah. You excelled at it.
I excelled. Yes. Yeah.
I think it's so fascinating. This has come up with other guests and I would say it's true for me as well. When I asked this question about when we were kids, would you have been a fat kid? That answer. And I wonder if it's because I think we're around ish the same age. And I wonder if it'd be true now for kids, but this idea of, well, no, I wouldn't have called myself fat, but my body definitely did not fit in. And so that's like such an interesting middle ground to occupy as a kid.
And I hear it so much in the folks I work with.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're like, I would kill for the body I had when I was 60. I hated it, right? But looking back in the pictures, I'm like, oh, if I had just not gone down the dieting cycle, right, I wouldn't be here. Like if someone were just told me at 16 that it's okay, right, that it's all going to sort of normalize out and you can be in the body that you're in wherever it goes, it's not a problem. Like it, like the grief that it could have saved folks, like years of torture.
Honestly, yeah. Yeah. I don't know about you, but I feel like this is one of the big motivators for me to doing this podcast and doing this work in the world is if one person themselves or helps their child not start dieting, then my work is done. Like, because most people listening will know, and of course you do as well, like the amount of emotional, physical, mental energy. It's like, who could I have been? I could have been a CEO at 20. You know, the amount of energy I put into trying to force my body to be different than it was. Oh, and calorie math and all the things. And I love that you use the word grief because there is such a body grief around this, you know?
So what you're saying is exactly why I love Star Wars. And believe it or not, Star Wars shows up in my work all the time.
Tell me. Oh, I'm so interested.
Yeah, I have all this Star Wars.
I know. I can see. And you've got a Yoda over your shoulder. And
So there's a, you know, they. I think of dieting as like being like Darth Vader. Okay. And like sort of being in your body is sort of like Yoda and using the Force. And Yoda has this great quote. He says, fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. Once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny.
Yeah. Oh my God.
You know, and I love that line because I think about like the fear of being fat, right? And like the anger that it leads to with our body, right? And then the suffering. And like, it just goes on and on and on. And again, once you start down the path, it's going to dominate like your thinking and your sort of focus on food and body for some folks for their entire lives.
Yeah. Forever will it dominate your life. Oh my gosh, you have just changed. I love Star Wars. I'm a huge sci-fi geek, so I love Star Wars as well. But you've just like, that is such a perfect, perfect line. And then like this bigger metaphor here that you've just named. Wow. Oh, it's so true, Aaron.
Yeah, can I lay one more on you then?
Please, please.
So Yoda has this other quote that says, judge me by my size, do you?
Yes. Oh my God. And I can imagine him saying, I know exactly where that happens.
So, you know, and he's got this whole sort of like little monologue after light, because it's like, and well, you should not, because my ally is the Force and you know, goes on and on. But anyways, that was the quote that I saw one day, and I was like, oh, there's a lot of stuff in here that I could probably use and connect with and like use as metaphors. So like, yeah, there's a lot of Star Wars stuff that I talk about all the time, both with clients, but publicly, right? But also like internally, like for me.
Yeah. Do you know, my first impulse is like, I must tattoo that on my body.
Oh, so I have a...
Do you have it?
Oh. I don't have that, but I have the rebellion sign with hope in the middle. So yeah.
That's so perfect.
The reason is because this podcast, right, being Finding Fat Joy, is a rebellion.
It is.
And it's a rebellion against something that most people see as okay.
Yes.
And so, but like when I think about rebellions, I think about community and I think about you need to find other rebels.
Yes, 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 yes.
And there might not be a ton, but there's enough. And like, how do we hold on to hope, right? Because rebellions are built on hope.
Yeah. Oh my God, you're totally speaking my language. My literal tagline for the podcast is a joyful rebellion against anti-fatness. Like, that's it. And that's why I'm fat and I only talk to other fat people, because it is about community and seeing. We have to see it. We have to know that there are amazing people out there living their very fat, joyful lives.
Yeah.
And that it's okay and it's rebellious and it's hard and we're going to do it anyway. Yeah. Oh, oh my God. I now immediately have to watch all the Star Wars again.
Well, listen, we can have like a whole series, right? Where we can like watch parties and like deconstruct them. I'm in.
I love it. Through a fat liberatory lens. Oh my gosh. Okay. So in. I wonder if that's been done. I wonder. Some PhD out there must have done it.
So I've done, I have a talk where I have all these quotes and in movie clip form and then talking about them through like a Health at Every Size fat liberation lens. Yeah.
That's amazing, Aaron. You know why I love that so much? Because most of the time when I'm watching something, I'm, especially with like stand-up comedians or things like that, or a romantic comedy, I am poised for the anti-fat bullshit that is about to barrage me. And so the fact that you have actually spun it and are like, here's all the like pro-fat liberation that we can find in movies, that is hopeful to me. That's great.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. You saying it that way too. And I'm with you. Like I, you know, my son, as he was, you know, in his early teens, maybe even like before that, really got into The Office. So I watched The Office with him all the time. And like, poor Stanley, like, and Kevin, like, just like beaten up with these horrible comments. And they're like, again, here's my point, right? That I said earlier. It's like the writer's room was brilliant, right? Like they got real lazy with those jokes. Like, could you be, and I know that, you know, they're writing for a character, but still like, oh my God, it's like the laziest joke you could come up with. Like work harder.
Work harder. I know. I recently watched an episode of The Office. I hadn't watched it in a while. I think last time I watched it all the way through was probably, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago or something. And I was like, oh no, it's just filled with it. But I think this is like, I think the last time I watched it must have been before I was as educated as I am now about fat liberation. And it's such a disappointment because it really ruins it for me. And I can't engage with it in the same way. And there's a lot of shows like that. I mean, Friends is like that. I used to love Friends. Now I can't handle it anymore for a lot of reasons. And it's just, and then that's why I think I get so frustrated when it still happens in shows and comedy specials. Because you're right. It's fucking lazy, people. Like, come on. Like, you're smart writers. Do better. Get more clever. Yeah. Okay, so I wrote down my second question so I wouldn't forget, and I'm glad I did, because I'm really curious, Aaron, how did you get into being a dietitian, first of all, given what you just said about your experience with a dietitian, and then into eating disorder focus, and I know you do a lot of work with men as well, so walk us through some of that. How did that happen for you?
Like I said, I dropped out of college, and I worked in... So I'm 50, right? 51 now. Wow. And so I dropped out, and then there was like the internet.com boom. And so I worked in internet video game design And I was a internet game producer, did a lot of kids games, worked for studios. Anyway, I was doing that for my job. And it was, again, at that point in my life that I sort of pulled out my mental filing cabinet and did all the things that that dietitian, when I was 15, told me to do. That I did them like in my 20s. And she taught me how to have an eating disorder. Like, they were totally eating disorder behaviors. And I did it. And I got a lot of praise. I got a lot of reinforcement. Whether I would have fit like formal criteria to be diagnosed, it doesn't matter. It was shitty for me. I was really like in it. Also like fueled by all of the praise and all of the stuff that goes along with it. And so it was in that mindset that I was like, I need a new job because I hated work. I hated the work I was doing. I'd come home Friday and cry because I had to go to work on Monday. And so I finally, like, I realized I need to change. And I went to a career counselor. I read some books. Anyways, I knew I wanted to work with people. I knew I wanted to like do something like one-on-one with people and, you know, make some sort of difference in people's lives. And I was like, I had the hubris. It was like, well, if I have lost weight, I can teach everyone else how to lose weight. And I really wanted to be like Richard Simmons in some way. And so it was with that mindset that I went back to school to become a dietitian. And I will tell you, I think it is a profession where a lot of folks go into because of their own relationship with food that sometimes is not that great, right? But you know, it's a profession where you get to like obsess about food all the time. So that's why I went back to school at 30 to become a dietitian. I was going to be the weight loss dietitian. And it wasn't until I finished my internship and I was working that I really found out about intuitive eating. And, you know, in Southern California, we're really fortunate because both co-authors are local.
Co-authors of Certified Body Trust?
No, of intuitive eating, yeah. And so I heard one of the co-authors, Elise Resch, speak at a professional dietitian meeting somewhere. And it just sort of hit. And I read the book and I emailed her and she responded and was like, I do supervision every month if you want to join. I'm like, yes. And really that supervision I went for a while. And those sessions were really, honestly, my therapy. It was, you know, a pretty small group in her office talking about cases, but, you know, she would also share thoughts. And I really just sort of realized this is not working for me, but also in my work, right? I was working at the VA and I was running a weight loss program. And I sort of realized like, hey, this isn't working for my clients either. And I tried for a long time to straddle both and sort of teach them about intuitive eating. But also like there was this weight loss focus. It wasn't working. And I finally realized I need to leave. I can't do this. Like this is no longer ethical for me to actually do this work. Like I'm hurting people.
Yeah. Can I ask about that tension, Aaron? Because that's a big tension to hold as it's growing within yourself and thinking, oh shit, like what now? And then also seeing it with your clients. Like how was that for you as this realization was getting bigger and bigger? Because I've had a similar experience and it's like, what is my world even?
Yeah, it definitely felt like a big shakeup, for sure. I think for me, the beginning part of like realizing I could be a little bit more free around food was actually just such a relief, right? I brought the same thing for lunch to when I worked at the VA and my internship, like probably for like 3 or 4 years.
Chicken breast and the salad?
No, Amy's. I mean, you really want to know? Amy's enchiladas.
Oh, really? Because probably it was like a predictable, like probably calorie count, blah, 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 all that stuff. Yeah.
And
boring.
Super fucking boring. Yeah. It's great every now and then, but like for 3 or 4 years, no, it's not.
No pleasure.
No. So that was nice, right? Like that, that landed. But I think the work stuff was really hard because here's the reality is that I knew it wasn't working, but I had to pay the bills. And a lot of my colleagues are in similar spaces, right? Where they're like realizing I can't work this way, but I'm sort of stuck in this job because I need to pay the bills. I need some income. I can't just cold turkey leave.
Well, and the problem too is like dietitians and nutritionists have been slotted into being, you go for weight loss as opposed to full body wellness. You know, it's, that's the problem too, is the professions has been so pigeonholed.
Like I was like, how do I look this up on Indeed? Right. I want to be a right. Like it doesn't show up. And so again, that's where I realized I think I need to work with folks who have eating disorders, because in supervision with Elise Resch, most of the folks that they were talking about had eating disorders. And I realized that's the conversations I want to have. Like that's like the sort of depth of nuance I want to be a part of with folks and their relationship with food. And so, you know, I was able to find a couple part-time jobs to piece together, and it all sort of worked out. So eventually I took a big leap of faith and I was like, I'm leaving the VA and I'm going to just sort of do this, and it'll sort of slowly come about. And it did. So, it was a long period of time, that transition, right? To like, again, that reckoning of I can't do this for myself, and that played out over time to work. And, you know, I think what I'm really appreciative of is there were a lot of people who were around me, both personally and professionally, that allowed me to evolve and weren't like, you know, I never felt like shamed for it. I never like felt like I'm not doing it fast enough. It was just like, you know, you have the space to sort of develop in this. And that was really helpful. And to eventually where I was like, you know, I had enough sort of time where I could eventually just work full time with folks who had eating disorders, both in, I worked in treatment settings for a little bit. I had my private practice and sort of slowly building a name for myself, and sort of how I got here. And like I said, I'm super happy I'm here. Like this is where I really feel like I am meant to be. And it's really hard. Like it's a really, really challenging job. I love it. It's challenging being a fat dietitian. I love it though. And so like, again, I think through this whole evolution, right, I feel like I've really landed where I need to be.
Oh, so great. That's so good to feel rooted in where you've landed. Yeah. I again, talking about tension and holding two things being true, you know, this idea of being a fat nutritionist with the assumptions of why people go to a nutritionist, a dietitian. When you're doing eating disorder work, I've had several guests who really specialize in eating disorders. And one of the big challenges in eating disorder treatment, as I've been learning, is, and experienced myself as a binge eating, as someone who has binge eating disorder, when going through treatment, is that, like you said, the recommendations are often basically just deepening the eating disorder, because if there is weight gain, I mean, I had a guest on who, as she was in full treatment, like a full facility, inpatient facility for eating disorder treatment, her body started to recover and gain weight, and her insurance kicked her out of the program for weight gain. It is so bananas to me. So this tension of eating disorder treatment is going to change our bodies, but then that triggers for a lot of people a response of fear about their body changing. So I guess my question is, very rambly question, can you be anti-diet and be a nutritionist? How do you hold that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think part of what that tension for me was, you know, I think about one of the things that shows up a lot in my work, and when I became a certified body trust provider, was talking about how can we externalize the problem outside of your body, right? Instead of like diving in and focusing on, oh, my body's a problem, it's this area, I eat too much of this, blah, 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 is how do we externalize the problem? And to me, that forces us to look at the systems that we are a part of. And that are oppressive. And so insurance, and yeah, there is some eating disorder treatment, and healthcare are rooted in a lot of fat phobia. You know, they're rooted in a lot of capitalism. They're rooted in white supremacy. They're rooted in these systems that sort of keep the cogs gears going, right? And a good friend of mine told me, like, we're part of this work, this rebellion, right, is pushing up against those cogs. So I think about that tension of, okay, I know as a dietitian, right, on the floor, I'm doing the right thing. Like, this person, I know it's radical for people to think, but like, this person, even though they're in a larger body, is weight suppressed. They're not eating enough. They're not eating enough. And part of their recovery is to normalize eating, which means, yeah, eating more. Is it expected that they would gain weight? Yeah. And that's okay. It's not a problem. It's actually might be part of the goal, which could be really beneficial if that person, again, is not eating enough and weight suppressed. We would do that for anyone except a person in a fat body. And so part of the tension is knowing that this path is really where it needs to be. And then there's going to be these systems that show up that say, hey, you know what? You're not doing it right. And, you know, part of the folks who are really like pushing eating disorder treatment in directions that it needs to go are having really good conversations with insurance, with providers to say, like, you know what? We're actually right, right? If you just sort of listen out, right? We know what we're doing. Here's the research to sort of back it up. And, you know, sometimes, not all the time, again, it's a rebellion, it's not a full sale change. Sometimes it actually is working, right? Some people are getting more care, right? Getting the sort of the support they need. But again, there is a tension. And ultimately, it's why I left working in treatment.
Hello, it's Sophia, and I'm jumping into this episode to invite you to subscribe, rate, and review the Fat Joy podcast. If you've been enjoying the guests and their stories, please let the algorithms know by subscribing, giving us a 5-star rating, and leaving us a review. You'll be helping raise awareness of Fat Joy because then we'll get ranked higher on the podcast charts. I mean, we're already in the top 2.5 globally, which is amazing, but I want top 1%, please. I love doing this podcast and creating the platform for guests to share their stories. So I would be so grateful if you can help me keep doing that by subscribing, rating, and leaving a review. Thank you, lovely. Okay, back to the episode.
You know, it is like, I couldn't do it, right? I couldn't have that tension anymore. And the board of directors here, right, is just me. And I get to be really fluid in how I work with folks. I get to like think about things a little bit differently. And I like that, right? And so I think what I would say in a long sort of answer is that tension is really hard. There are a lot of great people in treatment holding that tension. It is not tenable or sustainable though, right? So that's the hard part, is that there's this turnover of folks in treatment. And that becomes really, really challenging. And again, it's not, the people who suffer are the clients, right? The people that are needing help and maybe getting folks that don't have enough experience or don't, you know, quite know about as much how to be anti-diet. But there are some folks in treatment that are really trying to push that in the right direction.
Yeah, good for them. I mean, I don't envy that work. What you said about it not being tenable, I mean, I can really understand that. And because it's like, you would just be fighting bureaucracy all the goddamn time. Like, it's just, I can't. Kudos to anyone out there listening who was doing that, because that is some hero behavior. Yeah. So you also, and I wonder if this also, you know, you do this with your podcast. I'm curious if this is also true of your practice. You do a lot of work with men and their own relationships to their bodies. So I'm curious, because I will, for sure. I have not talked to as many men about diet culture and their relationship to their bodies as I have women, for sure. I mean, I would say 90-95% of who I talk to about body stuff are women. And so I'm really curious, Aaron, like, what are the similarities? What are the differences? Are there unique pressures, diet culture tropes? Like, what do men face? And I just want to share on your podcast, and you can say a bit too, you, and I've listened to a bunch of episodes where you have a guest come on and he tells his story, and it's beautifully done, and it's so raw and so vulnerable. And so I imagine you've probably observed some patterns, some things that you hear over and over again that men face. So tell us a little bit about the men. What's happening with men in their bodies?
It's really complex, you know, and I think part of what is hard, first off, is, you know, we talked about this offline a little bit before we started, is because there aren't as many voices, right? We're sometimes generalizing the experience of what men are, you know, going through. And the reality is that there's so many, right? I mean, there's like so many different things that are showing up because it's a varied experience. And, you know, I think the things that I would say that I've noticed in both working with men and doing the podcast Men Unscripted is there's no language for this. Like, men don't really have a language for what it means to feel uncomfortable in our body. I think the benefit or the advantage of being in a culture where this is such a female identified issue, right, is like you develop a language around it from very young. And for a lot of men, right, because it's like, it's more about like being teased or bullied, there's not really conversation around dieting or like, or what that feels like as much, right? It's just sort of like isolated, like we're trying to figure out the words in some way. And so I think we're behind, right, in that way, right? It's just there's not great language that folks can identify and say to really sort of hone in on what they're feeling.
I never thought of that before, Aaron. You're so right. So I'm so excited to talk to you. Yeah, you're right. It is a very, yeah, I'm even just thinking of like the words that we use around bodies as women and how that, and so, yeah, so what I'm hearing there is like men don't get the you should diet messages as much as women do, but they get teased and bullied, but there's like, I even hate that I'm saying these words, but like, quote unquote, at least with dieting, it's like, there's a solution for you. Again, we know it's a fucked up solution. We know it's not right, blah, blah, blah. But like with men, what you're saying is they just get teased and bullied, but there's no like what to do next.
Well, I think the issue that comes up with next is there's a lot around athletics and performance that is like, here's what to do.
Right. Get buff.
Right. Or here's how to improve your workout, right? Here's how to sort of increase your performance. And I think for folks who aren't participating in athletics, I think there is probably like some tones of dieting. But like, again, I've had so many folks talk about going with their family, with their mother, going with their mom to Weight Watchers and how horrible it was. Because they're the only guy in there. So I think what's interesting, right, is I think that there is a way that dieting feels, especially for a lot of younger folks, like emasculating, right? It seems feminine, right? This is what my mom does, right? It's not what dad does.
And even like watching their food or choosing certain foods or even like ordering the typical ordering a salad at a restaurant. Yeah. Oh.
So I think this is how like masculinity plays into this in a really significant way. And I think that's one of the sort of things that I really try to challenge, right, is what does masculinity really look like? You know, how can we expand our understanding of masculinity? And even like you said, how can we, like the word male, right? How can we expand our thinking around what it is to be male? And so I think those are like really big influence that people notice as when they're younger, you know, is that to be perceived anything other than masculine is really bad, right? So, you know, young men or boys that, you know, will have like, you know, man boobs, right? Let's like, again, just the word that they're using, right, is very emasculating. And so I think that's how a lot of this body shame shows up for folks.
Oh, my heart's breaking right now. It's so interesting. I have a 12-year-old stepson, and oh my gosh, I'm seeing so many of these patterns in him. You know, I think a friend told me once, and I always love this, they're like, kids grow out before they grow up. And so when he was in his growing out phase, he was told by the other side of his family from us that he was getting chubby and chunky and all these things. And so he started working out a lot more. And this is when he was like 10 and 11 and looking at the calorie count and sugar content of things. And it was just, oh, and then now he's 12 and kind of, you know, he was out and then he grew up. And so now he's leaner and everything is about like his masculine body that he's just dying for puberty to hit. So he'll start to grow some muscles. And I'm just like, I don't even know what to do with this kid now. Cause it's like, it's everywhere. The influence, everything he sees on TikTok, everything, like it's just a barrage about his body needing to be a certain way. And that certain way is hardcore masculine.
Yeah. And I think that's, there's more and more times as I'm, you know, living where I feel old, and here's one of them, is I think the presence of, no, I don't know if it's TikTok, right? I think it's like YouTube and like these sort of like male influencers that are really like reinforcing a lot of misogyny, a lot of like hypermasculinity, and like they have these huge followings. And they're perpetuating a lot of fat phobia, right? And a lot of body shame. And it's like, I have, you know, worked with some folks that have been highly influenced by that stuff. And it's like so hard to combat. But it's like, you know, look, I have the cars. Look, I have the jet and I'm ripped. And here are the women that I'm sleeping with. And, you know, it's like, wow, this is like, it's like a rock and roll figure, right? But like amplified by like 100 million, right? It's just like, cause there's so much more influence how social media plays out in these narratives.
And two, because the algorithms, if, you know, if my stepson watches that one, that's all he sees.
Yeah. Yep. Then you're in.
Yeah. Like you're really, oh God. And it's just starting so young. I mean, I met him when he was 8 and he was deep in this already at 8. Oh gosh, Aaron, what do men do? What do we do? How do we help our boys, our men?
Work out, eat less. No, just kidding. Totally joking.
I was like,
yeah.
No, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the really great question. Right. And my answer is, and I will tell this to individuals, but also to large picture, right? I think when we move into fixing, that's when we're sort of making choices that are rooted in shame.
Yes. When we move into fixing, as in like, I should fix my body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
And I think one of the things that I talk about with adults, right? Males, folks who identify as male and are adults, is what if we start to think about your body as not a project, that it's not broken, that it doesn't need to be fixed, and that you've, again, externalized, right? You've been taught over and over that it's not okay to be in your body, that it's not okay to have a feeling other than anger. It's not okay to show it, right? That you need to be productive. You need to be responsible. You need to be a provider. You need to hold up this level of performance in your life to be worthy. Those things take you out of your body. Right? Because if you've learned from very young, well, there's no pain, no gain, right? Like the only way you're going to perform is by breaking through, right? And suffering. Of course, you don't know anything else. So what if, right, we try to work on just being kind to your body? Like, let's just do things rooted in kindness.
Oh my God, Aaron, though, is that like so hard for men though?
Oh, incredibly. And here's why. Here's why, is I think kindness and compassion are seen as failures and giving up.
Well, and I also think they're hyper-feminized too. So it's like there's an emasculation component to them. And in our current, you know, patriarchal-driven society, men aren't allowed to be kind and compassionate. That's weakness and giving up. And
yet I think people really want to be.
Of course. I really think that too. Yeah.
And so again, I think about when that happens, right? That moment, like you said, right? It's like, well, I don't know how to do that. Well, of course you don't. Of course you don't. But like, what if we like just be curious and see what it's like? And so again, let's sort of like put it in context of what we talked about earlier, Sophia, is in my previous life as a dietitian, it was like, I'm going to tell you what to do and you're going to do it. That's the relationship we're going to have.
Yeah. And very rooted in power. You have the power, they don't.
100%. I even had a white coat.
Oh, fancy.
I had a fucking white coat. Some words. So, but now, right, I don't want to do that. I don't want that power. So I really try to tell folks, like, I'm going to give you some options and you're going to decide where we go. And I will be alongside with you in this journey to just continue to reflect and provide insight. But you get to choose where we want to go.
It's very coach of you. That's very coach. Yeah.
And so what I tell folks, right, is like, you can, if you feel like you need to go back to dieting, you can. That's your choice. But let's be really informed about what that will be like for you. Because of course you're going to have that pull. Like, again, it's the Death Star. Like, it is going to pull you, right? It's the dark side, right? It's going to pull you in, right? Because it's sexy.
That
it's
gravity healing. Field.
Yeah. Right. But like, there is another way there. And we just need to explore it. But I think it's this relationship that is very different where folks feel like, oh, you're not going to give me the answer. Not really. I'm going to give you a lot of tools, but I'm not going to give you the answer because I don't know the answer.
Well, and Aaron, I think that's also so beautifully rebellious because it's decolonial. Like it really flies in the face of all the oppressions, which are, we have the answer to your happiness. Do what we say, spend money on the things we say to spend money on, look the way we say you have to look. What you're doing is with what I would say is like, what sounds very much like a coach approach and not being the person of power, not being quote unquote the expert who has to, you know, lord it over someone, and having them be at choice in that way is so, I can just imagine, oh, the relief of that and the excitement to be kind of put back in self-autonomy and self-choice after, my own experience and my experience working with mostly women, all these oppressions are designed to have us not feel self-autonomy, right? And so, because why would they want us to feel that way? Then we'd make our own decisions. So you're returning that back to people.
And I will say the language that I'm using, it isn't different for whoever I'm working with, right? No matter what their gender is, it's sort of using the same language. I think where it really does sort of vary when it comes to male identified folks is really talking about, yeah, masculinity and patriarchy and all of these things that they just might not have ever really considered and how that's showing up in their lives.
Right. Like how deeply entrenched it motivates their behavior, what they say, what they do. Yeah. Oh, gosh. And the unmasking is so powerful, but also so terrifying.
Oh, it's, you know, so my supervisor told me something really great about a couple of years ago. It was like, we lean and we fall back into the suffering we know. And going forward is highly scary, unknown, right? So when the shit hits the fan and people fall back, it's like, well, of course you fall back. We fall back into what we know. Forward is scary and unknown. And who wants to go towards unknown, right? But yeah, it is. It's really scary in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, we're disrupting people's worldviews. And, you know, hence why we are rebels.
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole for sure that they're going down.
Wow. Oh, so I feel like I've just learned so much from you, Aaron. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your two podcasts. I want to make sure we highlight them because I think they're both great.
So the first one I did, we're not doing new episodes anymore, but it's still up. It's called Dietitians Unplugged. And someone that I met through the VA, her name is Glennis Oyston. We immediately connected because she was one of the first rebels that I met, right? It was like, oh, I'm sort of learning about health at every size and intuitive eating. And she was like, I know all about that stuff. And I was like, oh my God, fucking A, great. This is awesome. And so at one point we were just sort of putzing around one day. And I think, I don't know who came up with that. We're like, we should do a podcast. Like, let's just talk. And we're like, okay. And so, you know, one of the things that really appealed to us is like, we could just turn on the mics and just talk. And it turned in, we interviewed a bunch of people. And so it's a really great resource for folks listening to two anti-diet dietitians, right? Sort of connecting with a lot of different folks about these topics. So it was really fun to do. And Glennis, like, I think part of my whole purpose of that show was to make Glennis laugh. So I really excelled at that. And so that was part of my purpose. And then, and we stopped doing those episodes, I think, right around the middle of the pandemic. And then I realized after a couple of years, I was like, I think I'd like to do another show. And I didn't know quite what to do. And realized, you know, I don't know if there are any podcasts that are about men in this. And how do I do it? And I didn't want to do podcasts where people were coming on, men were coming on to promote something, right? So I didn't want providers. I didn't want like people who, you know, were trying to sell their program or whatever. I really wanted to just talk to folks. How do I just talk to folks? Because to be honest, it's super helpful for me. Like, I'm convinced about no one listens to my show because I don't care. I just want to talk to someone and it's really nice for me to talk to people, you know? And so I sort of put out this call on my Instagram. I was like, I'd love to, if you're interested in talking to me about your body story, let me know. And I said, it's going to be anonymous. And I got like 10 people within like 2 days. Who just like didn't know me, never heard, some of them knew who I was, like, you know, online, but stuff, but sort of trusted me that, oh yeah, I'll do this. And so I did 10, and all of those interviews are anonymous, right? So I just hopped on. I said, we used aliases. Folks will notice that when folks came and they didn't have an alias plan, right? I needed to have something. So I went through the names of band members of Metallica. So you'll see all the band members of Metallica listed in there. But really just said like, hey, tell me a little bit about, you know, we would start. And they were just really raw, open conversations with men about their body story. And I was not prepared, but some of them were like super emotional. And talked about some really, really vulnerable stuff. And that's why I knew that having an alias was really important so that no one would know who this person is. That way they can share what they needed to share. And then I figured, well, I did 10. I waited a little bit and then I did another 10. So there's 20 up. I have 3 episodes where I actually interview people who are more known and they're not using their alias, and sort of talking about their journey and their body story. And then I've just been lazy, to be honest, but I probably just need to do another 10, cause I've had some people express some interest. But you know, like podcasting's hard. Like it takes a lot of work. And so, you know, in the middle of having a private practice, I'll probably get around to doing some new episodes soon. But the 20 that are up there are amazing. Like, I think they're really helpful. And what really resonated is when I did the second season, most of those folks were like, I heard season one, that person was me. Like, that spoke to me. Like, and so I had to come on because I think there might be someone else who will hear mine, who will be like, that's them, right? And I want to do that for someone else. And, you know, I think, again, community, that's how we know we're not alone. Like, there's someone else that has gone through this or is going through this just like I am and knows how shitty it is or how hard it is, but also how great it is to sort of break through some of it. And so, you know, knowing that those folks listened and that it spoke to them is what really filled my heart.
Yeah, I have tears in my eyes because I'm just so moved by the power of that. And talk about kindness and compassion. I want to do this for others. Like, I have to say, I very easily fall into the I hate all white dudes camp. And that's not true. What I hate is white supremacist delusion and patriarchy. I actually know and love a lot of men, you know, but I feel like you're helping remind me of that, and that male identifying folks also face this, like, we're not going to compare, but like an immense amount of pressure, just like female identifying folks, around how we're supposed to look and behave and act. And I'm so grateful to be reminded of that, Aaron.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. And it's been there's a different way to go about healing rather than doing like a bunch of cold plunges.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I was just watching Witcher Brand talk about cold plunging the other day. I'm like, why am I watching this? Ah, oh.
I think it's nice for dudes to hear that there's a different way.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Well, I'm so grateful to have had this conversation. I love that you are opening up a different way for people. And I do hope there are more podcast episodes of Men Unscripted on the way as well, even though, take your time, no hustle culture implied here, because I very well know how challenging it is to create a podcast. And I just want to thank you so much, Aaron. This has been wonderful. One last question. Talk to me about joy. What connects you to joy? How do you choose joy? What's your relationship to joy?
Again, very complicated word. I would say that part of my own journey is accepting that I'm allowed to have joy. It's something I still struggle with, right? I don't know if it's masculinity versus just our culture, but like, pleasure is not really okay, or even to sort of center me in that. I will say I love music, and really, really like can get lost in music. And like I said, I'm a very big Metallica fan. So they were just here in LA and I went two nights. It was amazing. I don't know. So for me, Metallica is, they say the things that are in my head that I'm not really allowed to say or feel. And it's dark, sure. But like, shit, we all got some darkness, right? And like, they just bring a voice to it. But also their riffs just like drive me. Like, I can listen to a Metallica riff and just be so happy. So I would say music brings me a lot of joy.
Yeah, amazing. And I love that you got to see them twice. Whenever I have experiences like that, I'm always like, oh yes, what's happening outside? The intensity of it matches my inside. And I always feel so like at equilibrium, which is very rare for me because I'm a lot. So like, feeling like, oh, there's a match. Or like, if I'm at the beach and there's a huge storm. So there's something about the intensity. And I love that you get to like, be in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I took my daughter, who's not a big Metallica fan, but is just like, sort of like, I'll just go, sure. And to see her face, and I took my son to a previous show to see their face the first time, like they play, like how loud it is, and like you can feel music, like
it comes. Yeah.
Their eyes sort of bugged out. I was like, yeah, this is awesome, and they sort of got into it. But yes, I like the intensity.
Yeah, amazing. Ah, wonderful, Aaron. Thank you so much. This was such a joy.
Yeah, my pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on. It's been great to talk to you, and keep up your work. I love your show. So thank you for doing it.
Thank you. Before we go, I'd like to read a poem, because poetry can reach our hearts in a different way. Poems can have us feel in a different way. And that's what this podcast is all about. Expanding our hearts, deepening our empathy, and inviting in joy. So each week, you get a new poem. Aaron Flores loves stories, as I know you could tell from the episode you just listened to. And I really think his stories are actually his gift to the world. So for this episode, I chose just a truthful poem by Gabriela Mistral called The Teller of Tales. The version I'm reading was translated by Ursula K. Le Guin. When I'm walking, everything on earth gets up and stops me and whispers to me, and what they tell me is their story. And the people walking on the road leave me their stories. I pick them up where they fell in cocoons of silken thread. Stories run through my body or sit purring in my lap. So many, they take my breath away, buzzing, boiling, humming. Uncalled, they come to me. And told, they still won't leave me. The ones that come down through the trees weave and unweave themselves and knit me up and wind me round until the sea drives them away. But the sea that's always telling stories, the wearier I am, the more it tells. The people who cut trees, the people who break stones, want stories before they go to sleep. Women looking for children who got lost and don't come home. Women who think they're alive and don't know they're dead. Every night they ask for stories, and I return tale for tale. In the middle of the road, I stand between rivers that won't let me go. And the circle keeps closing, and I'm caught in the wheel. The riverside people tell me of the drowned woman sunk in grasses, and her gaze tells a story. And I graft the tails into my open hands. To the thumb come stories of animals, to the index fingers, stories of my dead. There are so many tales of children, they swarm on my palms like ants. When my arms held the one I had, the stories all ran as a blood gift in my arms all through the night. Now turned to the east, I'm giving them away because I forget them. Old folks want them to be lies. Children want them to be true. All of them want to hear my own story, which on my living tongue is dead. I'm seeking someone who remembers it, leaf by leaf, thread by thread. I lend her my breath. I give her my legs so that hearing it may waken it for me. Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely, I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly fat joy day, and we'll talk again soon.